What particle physicists do, or high energy physicists do, is really try to understand what are the most basic building blocks of the universe. The standard model of particle physics is today's kind of best explanation of what we've been able to discover so far. There's probably a whole new dimension to our reality that we don't quite understand yet.
Welcome to Purposeful Lab, a Modja Center podcast. I'm Catherine Hadro with Dr. Dan Keebler. This episode, we're really delving into cosmology with this next guest. Tell us about what we're going to be looking at with this expert.
So this season, we're trying to do a little bit deeper dive on cosmology. And so we've had Dr. Stephen Barr on already to talk about this. But here with Dr. Aaron Dominguez, he's a particle physicist, and we're going to look at sort of the fundamental building blocks of our universe how these are ordered and how scientists study those and what that order sort of reveals.
Excellent. Well, let's get to it. Here's our interview with Dr. Aaron Dominguez. Dr. Aaron Dominguez, thank you so much for taking the time to meet us and to join our podcast.
Oh, thank you, Catherine. It's really great to be here with you and Dan.
It's great to have you. You are the provost of the Catholic University of America here in Washington, D.C., and you are a professional particle physicist who is a member of the National Science Board. How does a particle physicist become provost of Catholic University?
Okay, that's a great. Well, right now I feel like an amateur physicist and no longer a professional physicist. Being a physicist, really, that's what I wanted to do ever since I was a little boy. Like, being a scientist was something that was kind of imprinted on my heart since I was Chico. So that's what I always wanted to know.
Physics, not...
Well, I didn't know what a physicist was. I certainly didn't know what physics was really until going to college. But being a scientist was sort of always on... Always, I don't ever remember not wanting to do that.
But then
going to school, doing research, learning what physics is, becoming a particle physicist. We work on these very large collider projects, these very large international collaborations. And it's kind of a place to grow up with a bunch of other really, really smart people. And it's kind of like a university dedicated just to physics, right? A worldwide university dedicated just to physics. So learning how to work in those big teams, you know, that taught me how to work with other faculty members. And I guess there's probably a direct line somewhere in there between the big science and becoming a university administrator.
A collaboration.
Yeah, it's collaboration. It's discovery. It's search for truth. It's working with other people from different backgrounds, different disciplines. So yeah, it's awesome. I love it. And we do particle physics at the Catholic University of America too.
Yeah. So in terms of particle physics, particularly the last 100 years, the goals seems to be to identify sort of the fundamental elements of the universe and how they interact with the fundamental forces, things like quarks and leptons and bosons and so forth, and incorporate them into the standard model. Is that something you can explain in layman's terms? Like, what
Please.
Is the standard model of physics, and sort of what is it? What's its role? Right?
Well, what particle physicists do, or high energy physicists do, is really try to understand what are the most basic building blocks of the universe, what are the most basic building blocks of matter, and what are the rules for putting these things together to build the universe that we have. So the standard model of particle physics is today's kind of best explanation of what we've been able to discover so far. So it's all of the stuff we've discovered in the past like 100 or so years, like electrons and neutrinos and photons. The kind of stuff you probably learn about in high school, but also more esoteric particles like quarks and heavier versions of electrons and things. So it's actually, it's like a small periodic table of the basic building blocks of the universe. That's what the standard model of particle physics is. But it's not, we know that it's not complete. It's not like a theory of everything. In fact, it deliberately ignores some of the most important aspects of reality, like gravity. So we don't have a fundamental explanation for gravity in the standard model of particle physics yet.
Okay. Is that something that it leaves out deliberately, or is it something that it becomes too hard to incorporate, or is it something that just can't be incorporated into the standard model?
That's a great question. Probably people have different answers. I would say, from my kind of humble perspective, it's probably because we're not able to do it yet. If we could, we'd be bragging about our like explanation of gravity. But it's really hard to study because it's so much weaker than the other forces of nature. Gravity is so weak that it's really a negligible force in these particle interactions in the collider projects that we have.
Okay. Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating to me as a non-physicist is that, you know, back in the 50s, that Peter Higgs was able to look at the Standard Model, see something missing in it, and predict that there's this other particle there. So I think it speaks something about, you know, the order in the Standard Model, or so, you know. And so maybe you could talk about that and a little bit about what the Higgs boson is and what it was supposed to do, it was missing there, and how people knew something was missing.
Yeah. So back in the 1960s, Peter Higgs and some of his other colleagues, who eventually got the Nobel Prize for its, you know, proposing this particle in the 2012, nuclear physicists were discovering some of these fundamental particles that we now put in our periodic table of the Standard Model. Like, we knew about electrons for a long time. We knew about photons for a pretty long time. We started seeing the other like strong and weak nuclear forces. And they started finding like some basic theories, you know, that would explain how these things work together. But if you think about these particles, like an electron and its heavier version of muon, and they have a fundamental mass. So they have like something that gives them substance, a mass. And that mass doesn't come out of any of the theories. It's just kind of arbitrarily there. Like, where does this mass come from? And so either it's just completely arbitrary and comes out of nothing, and you write it in there by hand, or it comes out of some other generative, you know, property of nature. And so, in fact, the theory that they had at the time didn't really work that well with particles having mass. But we know that that's true. We know why particles have mass, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here in our chairs. We'd be like flying around at the speed of light, which would be fun, but it'd be kind of hard to like...
If we had a theory for gravity.
Right, yeah. So the Higgs boson, this Higgs particle, is a way to kind of generate the masses of these other particles. And that was kind of the linchpin that makes this Standard Model work. The problem is it took us 50 years to find it. So, yeah.
Can you expand on that? You know, why was it so difficult to you know, discover the existence of the Higgs boson? This has been a major part of your career. And can you speak about that 50-year process?
Yeah, it wasn't through lack of trying. I could tell you that. So like, you know, even when I was a graduate student, that was the subject of my thesis. My dissertation as a graduate student was searching for the Higgs boson. And this is in the 1990s. And we didn't find it. I still graduated. I still got my PhD. But what we did was we closed down like a window that it doesn't exist in. So we kind of proved that it doesn't exist in this particular window of possibilities, and then move on. And that's how science has kind of progressed from the 60s through the 2000s when we did discover it. And it's so hard. It's been so hard to find because it's really hidden in the universe, and requires a tremendous amount of energy to kind of make it come out and be able to observe it directly. And that's been very hard to do. So that's why these particle colliders, if you've ever seen pictures of them, you know, they're huge. They're like the sizes of entire cities. And that takes a lot of very, very clever engineering and physics. That's just not easy to do. So it took us a very long time because it's super hard to create. It's very rare. And you have to create trillions of these interactions between these particle collisions just to get a few of these Higgs bosons. So it takes a long time.
And what was collided, and how long did these things show themselves before they sort of disappear, yeah, like back into the fundamental?
So there have been different types of collision, you know, experiments to look for the Higgs boson. The one that found it is at the Large Hadron Collider collides protons, so the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. Right, so you just take a bottle of hydrogen, turn it on, strip off the electron, put it into accelerator going in different directions, and bammo, you make a little nuclear explosion 40 million times a second. And out of that, every so often, like every one trillionth of a time, you pop one Higgs boson out. But we've been looking at other when we had other versions of these types of hitters too.
Maybe on a personal note, what was it like to be a part of that massive, large-scale physics team?
It's pretty hard to describe, except like imagine yourself on the set of some science fiction movie, right? Or being in some space station orbiting Jupiter, but it's real, right? You're down 150 meters underground in this cavern, the size of a basilica with this giant particle detector in there, kind of all sandwiched together with millions of different cables and people from all over the world speaking like every language, all working together, you know, and on this common project that's bigger than any one person.
Well, and for someone who grew up wanting to be a scientist, I can't even imagine what that was like for you.
Yeah.
Too.
It was awesome, except I had to learn French. So that was the hard part. Yeah.
What was your role then in terms of your specialty? Because obviously we have people of all different specialties that are doing different parts of this project.
Yeah.
And how do you detect this thing, right? So, yeah. You know, if you can't see it, you can't, right? Well, how do you know it is the Higgs boson when they found it?
Yeah. Well, I've been super fortunate to play roles kind of across the spectrum in particle physics. Most recently, maybe in the past decade or so, been my group and me and my colleagues have become pretty good at making particle detectors that are sensitive to particles that come from this nuclear explosion that have a charge. So like an electron or a proton, something with a charge. And as it comes from this explosion, these particle detectors that we build can make like a three-dimensional movie of this explosion and kind of reconstruct what happened in the kernel of that hard interaction. So it's not so different from the kind of technology used in a cell phone camera, except that it has to be radiation hard. So it has to be blasted by megarads of radiation, has to be super lightweight so that the particles don't get disturbed when they go through it. And it has to run unattended deep underground for like a year. Other than that, yeah. So, but that's what it does. It just tracks. It makes it reconstructs the paths of these particles coming from the explosion.
I think that, it's funny. You think about how much money is spent putting in, how many careers I put into, you know, identifying this, that there's some faith there in sort of the rational structure of the universe that, you know, this thing, because you have to think this thing actually is there, right? And we're going to put in $1 million and man hour and so forth that, what does that do you reflect on that, what that means as a scientific community that we're willing to do that?
Yeah. And in fact, we didn't know that the Higgs boson was there. We only knew where it wasn't. That we weren't guaranteed that we understood the universe well enough to know for sure whether or not a Higgs boson or something like it existed or not. We had a pretty good, inkling that there must be something like that. Otherwise, we wouldn't have spent so much time to do it. But you're right. It's kind of a worldwide effort from people of all different backgrounds, really having a common cause, which is to try to understand the creation, God's creation at its most fundamental level. And I think that kind of exploration speaks, it's written in the human heart, right? It's somehow part of natural law that humans have this desire to understand the creation, the beauty of the universe that we live in. I think that's why people go sail across the ocean, and that's why we try to look for these esoteric particles. It's really trying to understand the creation that we live in.
Something that Dan mentioned earlier that he really appreciates about standard physics is that there is that order at that foundational level, which is why you're all able to believe that this Higgs boson existed. Can you speak to that? You know, as a physicist who explores this order at such that foundational level, how do you make sense of that, and how does that originate?
I mean, it's amazing that it's so orderly, I'd say, to begin with, because I don't think that's guaranteed. There's nothing really that guaranteed the universe was intelligible or orderly or rational. But it certainly is. It's like super rational.
Yeah.
And we're able, like, again, we're designed, like we're made in a way to make sense of the universe.
We just kind of come out that way. God made us this way.
Yeah.
And not just like Catholics or Americans or French people. It's like all of us from the beginning of time, like man has been made to do this. So that's a pretty amazing fact. And I think that is recognized by all scientists, and that we can, from all these different backgrounds, you know, ask these same questions from all of our different points of view, with this acknowledgement that there really is a truth, right? There's an actual truth. There's an actual truth to in order to the universe, and it's not just a matter of feeling or emotion or perspective or whatever. The facts actually lead to a truth.
Yeah,
these predictions, the mathematical predictions of particle physics, seem to be borne out every time.
Yeah,
you have. Well, there's some. We have the ability to model this, and it actually seems to correspond to reality. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of a corollary to the whole thing. Is that mathematics, which really, if you think about what is mathematics, it's kind of this purely abstract internal like notion that comes out of your own brain. That mathematics actually describes the way the universe works is again just amazing. Like it didn't have to be that way. It could have just been utter chaos, right? The universe could just have been utter chaos, but in fact, it's describable by mathematics. So in some sense, God is like a mathematician. Like he actually he's like the greatest mathematician in a sense. And we little human beings are able to understand that.
That hits on exactly what we explore, you know, here at the podcast, A Purposeful Lab. You know, an overarching interest of ours is understanding our place in the universe and looking at the long chain of events in nature, from physics to chemistry to biology. So just kind of digging even deeper on this topic and your experience in examining these building blocks of the universe, truly, what does that offer about? And this is a big question, but from your perspective, what does that offer on the understanding of the meaning of human life?
Yeah, so we do try to answer a small set of questions, although they're not easy to do. You know, it takes a lifetime to actually answer some of these things. But they're pretty simple. Like, what is this bottle made out of? Like, at its most fundamental level, and we've got a pretty good description of that. But what does that tell me about life, right? Not a whole lot. It just tells me kind of what this is made of. But when you start looking at really how the whole universe is put together from its inception, not only is this bottle made of, you know, quarks and leptons and gluons and electrons, but it's here because of the way the entire universe came into existence and works. Like the whole thing, which came out of nothing. So our particle physics has helped us understand that the universe was created out of nothing. Like there was no, it wasn't like empty, like an empty space with a pile of stuff that accidentally blew up for no reason. There was literally nothing. There was like no space or time. And the whole universe came into existence about 13.8 billion years ago, out of nothing in a way designed with the kind of physics that we can study for us to be here and have this discussion.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's so mind-boggling, and it's also so true that, like, what does that tell us? How is it that that happened and we're here having this discussion? We have families, we have people that we love, you know, we have lives, we know what, we have beauty. That how is that possible unless there's a loving creator, the super, super powerful loving creator that made not the whole universe in a way for this to take place? In a very beautiful way. Like that's just, I don't know how you can not see that and not just have your brain blow up.
Yeah. You know, as a biologist, let's say you look back and say, okay, well, you know, what makes us, you know, biologically alive? And so when you look at the order in the chemistry that biology takes advantage of, it takes advantage of certain things in the chemistry to produce living organisms, right? And that order flows there. And then why is the chemistry the way it is? And you're like, well, it's because you have these certain atoms and these certain combinations, and then these, you know, and so why do you have those? And you go back to the physics of why is there mostly hydrogen and why is there less, lead or whatever in the universe? And you can sort of see based on the physics, and you know, well, the order of the physics dictates these are the more stable ones, they're more abundant, and then you go back, what dictates the physics? And you reach a point where it seems like you're at the level of this is the fundamental fabric of why of reality, right? And then it's why is that is your answer. It didn't have to be that way, right? It's a gift to creation, right? But all of these other things are dependent on what you're studying, right? There is no frog. There are no frogs if there aren't stable, subatomic particles, right?
It's all true. And that's what physics and science can answer is like, how does the world work? But what it can answer is like, why? Why is it this way? That's not even a scientific question, really, when you think about what it's asking. And that's an obviously important and profound question that any person with a beating heart would want to know the answer to. And that's where you see God's beauty exposed, I'd say.
So you hinted at this you mentioned the standard model about doesn't incorporate gravity, but what are the other things like for a young physicist, like, okay, oh, they found the Higgs boson, so the standard model is what's left to do,
sometimes you'll hear people say, oh yeah, science has figured it all out, go do something else, we've got it all tidied up and it's going to be in a textbook for all eternity, and that's all you have to do is read the book.
There's a lot of that in the late 1800s in physics, and turned out.
Right, and then quantum mechanics, like, she reared its head, and like, what? Who ordered that? Let me give a rough sketch of the entire universe here in 10 seconds.
Okay.
All right?
Great.
Okay.
Out for the challenge.
So I mentioned this stuff that's in our standard model, and the stuff that we're made of, right, and the stuff that stars are made of. The stuff that you can see in the sky when you look out there with your own eyes or even with a telescope, all of that stuff, which we think would make up the whole universe, really only makes up 5% of the energy and matter content of the universe. Only 5%. So the stuff that we know about, the stuff that we've spent all this time on, the thing that I spent my whole career trying to study, we only get 5% right on this physics test. And I don't know about you, Dan, but in physics, right, you don't get a passing grade if you get 5% out of 100. So there's really a huge amount of ignorance about what the universe is made of. And right now, we give up these kind of funny esoteric names like dark matter or dark energy. So we don't really know what they are. We know that they exist.
And the reason we know they exist, you get into,
So we know that dark matter exists or something like it for quite some time now by looking at the rotational speeds of galaxies was probably the first inkling that there was something called dark matter out there. Some kind of invisible matter, really. It's not dark, like a dark black cloud. It's invisible. It's just everything goes right through it, including light, without interacting, but it interacts gravitationally and causes galaxies to spin too fast, according to our understanding of gravity. And so it's some form of matter it's kind of invisible. And we're not able to image it with the kind of detectors that I mentioned, and we're not seeing it directly yet in our particle collisions, although that's exactly what we're trying to do.
We know it's
literally trying to do it.
Because it has a gravitational effect, and so it has to be a...
We think so. We think that it's some new form of matter, like the standard model. Imagine this mini periodic table. It's missing like some dark matter particles. But in order for that to happen, there's probably a whole new dimension to our reality that we don't quite understand yet.
The fact that there is so much more to explore and research and understand and examine, 95%, is that exciting for you? Is that daunting for you? I mean, what do you make of that?
It's humbling for sure. Like physicists and scientists, usually we're pretty smart and pretty good at what we do in order to be able to achieve what we do. But, if you really think about the enormity of the task, it's, this is one tiny little micro step in mankind's, progress here in understanding. So, but I don't get into it to try to understand every single thing about God. Like you try to understand the beauty that you do learn is it's like a profound experience where you're living out like a completion of who you're made to be. So I don't know if you have the same kind of things. And when you find something in biology, how things work,
you're not understanding everything about biology.
You just understand something new, particularly that you've been struggling with and wrestling with for years, and you figure it out, or at least another piece of it. It's like, okay, we're meant to know, and we want to know. And it's like, oh, I didn't waste 4 years of life. I actually found something, you know, and whether it's, you know, in dolphin, it's not earth shattering, but it is, you've gotten closer to understanding reality, even if it's a small part. It is, you're part of a bigger community, and that's it.
This field is totally new to me, but when I was doing some research about, you know, your background and the Higgs boson, it's often referred to as the God particle. Can you explain why is that, and why could this cause some confusion?
Okay, yes, it does cause confusion. I'll say that. So here's the story, at least as I was told it. So there was a famous physicist named Leon Lederman. He was, when I was a postdoc at Berkeley Labs, I was actually stationed at Fermilab in Chicago, which is where he was working. And he eventually got the Nobel Prize for the work he had done. And he was co-authoring a book with somebody about particle physics, including the Higgs boson. And the journalist who was writing it with him asked him a question about it. And he called it the G-damn particle, okay? not the God particle, but they wouldn't let him call it that because it was so difficult to find. So they shortened it to the God particle.
It was out of frustration.
Out of frustration, right.
Okay.
So that's the story of how it became the God particle. He was so frustrated by it that, and then his editor was clever and snagged that as the title of his book. So
right before that even existed, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. It's funny how you talk about earlier about working on these big projects with people from all over the world and different subdisciplines in physics. Sort of prepared you to be provost at Catholic University. I'm interested to see what because you before that in between you ended up at University of Nebraska. So your career journey from working at CERN and that project to Nebraska to Catholic U.
I mean, I've been super fortunate, Dan, to have had opportunities open up for me in my career and been able to take advantage of them. Nothing's ever with these things,
right.
You know, I remember sweating over finishing my dissertation. I remember sweating over my first job interview as a postdoc. I remember sweating over the interviews to be a professor and sweating over, you know, my tenure decisions. All of those steps are like branch points that could lead to a different direction for all kinds of reasons, life reasons, just anything, right? It looks like a linear path.
Yeah.
Right. For me, I guess, but it was, didn't have to come out that way, and I could have gone in a different way and probably been just as happy and fulfilled. But it did lead me into a career in physics at Nebraska, and I loved it. I love Nebraska. It's where we raised our daughters. I love the Midwest. It's just a wonderful part of the country. I have nothing bad to say about it, and I have nothing bad about all the places I worked at, but I was missing a piece of my life as a Catholic, being able to put together these two halves of myself, right? As a man of faith and as a scientist, that was never like, there's no internal battle between these things, right? It was never some dichotomy internally, but for sure in my job, there's limits,
right?
About what you can do, what you can talk about, what you can discuss in class, things like that. But a Catholic research university like Catholic University of America is an opportunity where you can more naturally reconnect something that should not have been disconnected in the beginning, which is this exploration for truth from both faith and reason. And that was being able to, you know, conceive of a job where I get paid to do that.
Yeah.
Was just like, all right, I'll give that a shot. And I got interviewed for the job to be the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Catholic U. And that's how I ended up becoming provost after that, accidentally. But it was an opportunity to kind of connect my lives together.
Well, on that point, and that's such a gift, you know, that you are able to integrate your faith and your scientific expertise together. You know, I imagine because standard physics explains so much, when it comes to the forces of the universe, there might be people who remove God from the situation if they see all that can be explained from physics. What's your response to people who remove God and feel that he's not needed in this equation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you just think about what science does and what it's for, there just are a whole host of questions that it just is not set up to answer. I mean, that's just not what science is for. Science is a great way that we've developed to understand the natural world in a particular way, but it doesn't answer some of the most obvious things, which are actual, like, observable facts, like love. Love is an objective fact, truth, right? We all experience love. We do. But science has got nothing to say about that thing, which is true, which exists. I mean, it's got nothing. I mean, maybe somebody says, oh, it's just evolution. It's some chemical thing. That's like the lamest explanation I've ever
heard. This part of the brain and that part of the brain, but the actual experience that you have, that we all have, that we can share and talk about. Yeah, it goes beyond.
So there's a whole host of questions like that that science is not set up for. And that's fine. I mean, that's how it's supposed to be. So if you were to like delete the whole rest, one half of the universe, and all you had was just the natural world, okay, then maybe science is all there is, but it's just not, obviously not true. There's that. And then again, if you just go back to the beauty and profound beauty of the universe and natural world and why it is the way it is, again, science doesn't really explain why that is.
There's a great book, I can't remember the author, The Evidential Power of Beauty. I can't remember the author, but it sort of makes that claim that the beauty in the universe, like there's why, you know, because that raises a question in most humans, like why does it have to be so beautiful? Even for me, you know, I miss the math. I'm sure the math is beautiful in the state of
the great equation.
I see beauty elsewhere in the cell. You know, people, you know, I look at the order of the cell, but you're looking at the natural world, the beauty there. That we all experience, like that there's something that goes beyond.
Well, even as you were discussing again the Higgs boson and searching for something that is hidden, I was just wondering how that paralleled with your faith life as well.
Yeah, well, look, it's not easy. None of this is easy, really. Some of us have gifts. Some of us, you know, have faith is a gift that's been given to us, right? Grace. And even like the greatest saints in the history of the world have struggled through dark nights like that. So it's not easy, is it? So, yeah, there are things that are hidden that we know that are there, that do take some effort. And I think that's part of our natures as human beings, is that we have to struggle sometimes to find those things. So. I think that's okay. I think that's okay. And it's that endeavor, that continuous orienting ourselves towards God and who we're meant to be, you know, and communion with him and each other. That's not easy work.
We're getting back to, you know, your role at Catholic University. You know, what is your vision? You know, what role does Catholic University play in the landscape of higher education, and what unique niche does it occupy, and what services does it do for higher education that, say, can't be done elsewhere? And sort of your vision. And full disclosure, I'm an alumnus, so I always look back at Catholic U, and I with seeing things that are happening there and that you're doing, which are wonderful. But I get your take on what you see as the role of it.
It's, you know, it's an American university, like the others here in the country at this time. It was deliberately put in Washington, D.C. and connected to the Catholic Church by the bishops in the late 19th century to be this research university for the Catholic Church in the United States, to help form the citizens of the United States to really contribute to the nation. And the church, that's who we're supposed to have been back then in 1887. And that's who we are today. And where we're headed is to just become a more complete version of that. So if we're doing it right,
what we're really trying to do is integrate our faith into everything that we do. Right? We're really trying to put Christ in the center of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? In our baseball team, in the cafeteria, you know, in the dormitories, in our physics class, in biology and philosophy and theology, always asking, where's Christ and how does that inform the way we do stuff? That's the design plan for Catholic University of America. But we're doing the highest level research, just like these other non-Catholic or secular schools, but with this integration.
What does that look like in practice, specifically when it comes to the field of science at Catholic University? What does that look like for students and faculty?
Yeah, it's, you know, in like particle physics, the kind of particle physics we do looks a whole lot like the kind of particle physics you would do at another research. We don't have our own private standard of, you know, approved standard model. No, it's like that's just, we're studying the same reality. But again, we approach it from this lens of faith. And you see this becoming more important in some of the other disciplines, like in biology, where, especially when it involves human life and our understanding of what a human being is, our understanding of that from our Catholic faith, that definitely changes the way we would do research, right? There's some things that we would never do because of the way that it would impact the dignity of life. That's different. That's something that we certainly changes the way that we do stuff at Catholic U in the sciences. That's an example.
Yeah, we were talking before we came on camera about how it's unusual. We got a provost who's a physicist, a president who's a engineer. Like you have sort of scientists leading Catholic U, which I love. You know, but yeah. do you have any sort of projects in science and faith, the things that in that nature that you see? Is it a vision of where the university is going or new things in that?
Yes.
Realm?
So we have, before the pandemic kind of changed priorities for a brief 3 years at universities, we were constituting an institute for faith and science at Catholic University. We have a lot of talented people already there working on various types of issues, and the notion is to bring them together to have these types of interdisciplinary discussions. So we have the people. We're trying to reboot this idea of an institute. We have lots of friends like Professor over here and all of his friends in the Society of Catholic Scientists around the world, and the notion is to build this up into a serious research, interdisciplinary research center with funded graduate students, visiting professors, endowed faculty positions, all exploring this kind of intersection between faith and science at a Catholic university.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. That's wonderful.
And I'm sure you'd be excited about that. Definitely. Yeah. You know, I'm curious, you have such this impressive career. Have you ever received pushback when it comes to your faith and various professional opportunities?
It's never been anything like super apparent. And I've never like been in a situation where I had to like completely suppress my faith. I think everybody who knows me realizes who I am, and that hasn't been something that's directly excluded me from something. But for sure, around these life issues, there were some lines which I was not willing to cross as an administrator that did cause problems. And in fact, there was a bit of a crisis. That is what led me to come to Catholic University of America. So sometimes God puts these types of things in front of us that feel like a crisis or a challenge, when in fact he's asking you to go do his work. And so So the answer is both no and yes, and also it changed my life. So all of those things.
Has it been like on a positive side, has it fueled your scientific discovery or insights in some way? Being a Catholic, has it affected your practice of science in a positive way?
I'd say absolutely so. Again, it's because the more I learn about how it all works, the more beauty I see, the more I see the fingerprints of God. And that strengthens my faith as a Christian. So being a scientist strengthens my faith as a Christian and vice versa. So that's awesome.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. No,
wouldn't you love to have a job where that's true?
They integrate.
Yeah.
Totally be an integrated person. They're not separate. They feed on each other.
And I'm not just like some complete weirdo on my own. I've got a bunch of friends who are all doing the same thing. Maybe just as weird, but yeah, they're just
thousands in this
thousands of
Catholic science.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, we're surrounded by people of like mind.
Well, as we begin to just wrap up this conversation and we're examining how you have this just really special insight into the building blocks of the universe, any final thoughts as we ponder this question as to whether there is purpose in the universe?
Oh, boy. Just small questions to wrap it up, like the meaning of the universe. Yeah, look, I think it is pretty clear that from all of the evidence, just cold facts, that the universe was created by a loving creator who, you know, the whole thing is put together in a way for us to be here. And it's inscribed into our very like being that we are meant to, with our minds and our hearts and our souls, know and understand God and be in communion with him and each other as people. Like those are just facts. And they're beautiful facts. It's not like tough luck facts, like, you know, that's kind of rotten the way it turned out. It's like the most beautiful thing ever. And that's true. So doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but those are the true facts of, how it all works.
That's a great thought to end on, and been a pleasure having you here.
Likewise. This is a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on.
It's an honor. Thank you. Well, I am so grateful for Dr. Dominguez's time and just his lived witness of being this Catholic scientist.
I think he embodies the integration of science and faith. You can pick that up just from talking to him, the energy that he had. Often that's even more important than arguments and showing how, you know, the order demonstrates this. And that is just, you know, people can look at someone that lives this sort of integrated life and say, oh, there's something there that they want to explore. They want, you know, I want to have that sort of integrated life. And that you can see how his faith actually spurs his scientific research, right? You know, I think the community that he talked about in terms of having, you know, a community of people that do this, not only scientifically, but also Catholic scientists, the Society of Catholic Scientists, that community where you sort of help build each other up.
I think at one point he even said, my faith makes me a better scientist. So again, really incredible witness, and the fact that he's really helping to cultivate this integration for future Catholic scientists as well. I mean, I'm curious as to your reaction as someone who also works in higher education, the importance of that.
His goal is to try to make this the best science possible at Catholic University. So it's world-class science done in an environment where your faith doesn't have to be put up on a shelf, you know, and that integration, we call for excellence and integration at once, which is, I think, his vision for science at Catholic University, for example.
I was surprised to learn, you know, again, as he's this prominent in the fields of physics, that we only, you know, really know about 5% of what is out there. That was striking.
Yeah, though no, that I think it speaks to, you know, it's not just physics. I think you can find that in just about every field, you know. I know certainly in biology, you know, there's all the really big questions are still open and out there. There's so much that we don't know. And once you find one thing, you know, you realize, okay, well, now that opens up a whole new a set of questions, you know, and a whole new vistas that you hadn't even thought of before. And I think science is, you know, engaging the mystery of creation, that the deeper you penetrate the mystery, the more you realize how big it is, I think, you know, that's what I found in my experience with science. And we've talked about this over and over on the podcast about the humility you have to have in front of, you know, this order that he talks about, right? The order at the level, at the foundational level.
And he really has a close-up view of that when it comes to the field of physics, that doing physics, you know, and you said this yourself, like presupposes that there is an order.
Right. You can't physics unless you think that there is something that's ordered in a pattern there for you to extract or discover, right? And without that, you said, could have just been chaos, right? But it actually is ordered. And it's not only is it ordered, but our intellect is such that we can perceive that order, right? And that is a great mystery in a sense. He mentioned, where does the source of that order come from? These are those deep metaphysical questions that he said, that science can't answer. Why is there this universe? Why is there a universe at all? And why is it this specific universe, one that's got this order and has Higgs bosons and Higgs fields and all the things that physicists, particle physicists have uncovered? Why is it a universe that has, planets that form in the way, they do? Why is it a universe that's capable of evolving cosmically and biologically? All these bigger meta questions that are, like you said, are natural to us as humans to ask, but science isn't going to answer it. In fact, science, though, does point that there's these bigger questions out there, and to ignore them or to say, I don't really care why the universe exists. It just is, I think it cuts off one of the most important aspects of human curiosity.
No, I mean, that was fascinating to hear. And also the insight he gave us, I mean, I could almost visualize his time at CERN. And that was a fascinating kind of inside look into that collaborative project.
Right. And it's very interesting how, and he said, well, we didn't know if we were going to find it. So yeah, it's this risk, science is a risk. And I know, you pick a project and I think, this is going to lead to something, but it's a risk. You might not find anything. And this was a huge risk because the amount of man hours and money that was put into it, that once you, the feeling of discovery must have been something just that goes beyond description when you put all that effort and faith into, hey, I think this exists. And it's not faith without any rational support. They had reasons to think this thing existed. It made sense that it would, but they weren't sure, right? And the amount of risk that goes into anything worthwhile.
And trust. True. It's like a both and. No, I was really edified by even just his spiritual insights that he shared with us as well, and how that goes hand in hand with his career.
Oh, definitely.
Now we're at the office hours segment of the show as we throw all types of questions to Dr. Dan Keebler and continue to just learn more about science in the news and what are some headlines. So, Dan, Reuters had this exclusive report recently in September that for the third consecutive month, traffic to OpenAI's ChatGPT has declined. It's going down. What's your reaction to this? Is this just because it was the summer and there were fewer students utilizing it? Is it indicative of something greater? I mean, is ChatGPT, is it losing its hype?
Yeah, I think, there's some, it's losing some of its hype, but not, AI is not going away and it's not going down. I think, people are becoming aware of sort of ChatGPT's sort of limitations. They wanted, I wanted to write a full term paper and it didn't quite do it the way I needed it to do. And there's, people are reporting, I see more errors in what it's giving me. And part of it is, I think there's some competition out there. People are trying other systems. And I know a lot of people were just on it for a few weeks trying to figure out what it could do and didn't really have any use for it and stepped back. But I think what's happening and what's going to happen is there's going to be, a splintering of AI systems that are geared towards, academics and biology, or one that's geared towards marketing, and you'll see these different, more tailored AI rather than a general AI, because it's much more difficult to get the general to answer every single question, because now there's more stuff out on the internet that's made up by AI, and the AI is scouring the internet to learn. So you have this sort of vicious cycle where AI is sort of training on what it just produced, so I think there's going to be more curation and more sort of focused AI that will be developed.
That makes sense. And it's learning from us too, isn't it? It's learning from its own errors probably and what we're inputting into it. I know I'm just kind of learning its capabilities. The other day I was meeting a friend who was coming from a different, area. So I used ChatGPT to find out where should I meet this friend that we can meet in the middle and it's an equal distance. I know people who have used ChatGPT to plan their vacations. You know, find me a place that's like a 2-hour drive away, family friendly. So it's fascinating to see how it will continue to evolve.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they need human people to curate it. I get emails from these AI companies. They ask like PhDs to sign up and help curate. Oh, we want to do a biology one. Can you look at it and play with it and give some feedback? So they were, you know, they're having, you know, experts in, you know, marketing or biology to do the feedback to develop these better sort of algorithms. We really need to have, you know, somebody come on and make this a topic of all of our future episodes, because I think everybody is interested in this, and everybody's already being touched by this in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. And I think as the school year continues, I'm interested to see if the traffic to it picks up. And if your students end up utilizing it a lot.
We'll look at midterms. So yeah. In the air,
we'll report back. Okay, well, there's a number of different articles on the link between shrinking brain size and climate change. So there's a new paper published in Brain Behavior and Evolution, and it considers climate change as a potential factor affecting brain size evolution, finding the decrease in brain size might be driven by natural selection in response to environmental stress, which began roughly 15,000 years ago. You've written a book on evolution. Should I be concerned about these reports that our brains are shrinking? And what do you make of this theory?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think you need to be concerned. You're doing quite fine.
It'll be okay.
But there is, I mean, this was a new study, but there have been a number of studies looking at, fossil record, and that the brain size in humans seems to have decreased over the last 20,000 years. Which, you know, the begs question, why and what does that mean? Because clearly we are able to do and have a much more complex society than we did 20,000 years ago. And this recent study was showing that there's a linkage between the climate. And maybe that's one of the factors that, a warmer climate is selecting for a smaller brain. And there's been some evidence that we sort of knew that already, is that hominins that live at higher latitudes where it's colder tend to have bigger bodies, bigger brains. And so that's been known. But this, even if you take into account body size, they still have bigger brains 20,000 years ago, really, than we have now. But this also gets to the point that it's not just the size of the brain, but it's also the organization of the brain that really matters. So just because the size has gone down, and maybe it's because one of the biggest things about the brain is you have to cool it, because it uses so much energy to cool the brain. And so, you know, a larger brain in a cooler climate is easier to cool. Possibly that might be one of the factors that plays into this. But a smaller brain that's organized differently might, you know, probably has the ability to do, you know, the same things, or has this, the organization is key. Right, because there's brains, particularly if you look in the fossil record 300,000 years ago, you see brains that look very similar to modern humans in terms of their size, but based on the shape, it's a little bit different. And so clearly it's organized differently. And so, with a smaller brain, do you organize it differently? And it's interesting, if you look at male and female brains on average, a female brain is a little bit smaller because females are smaller. And they actually organize their brain on average a little bit differently.
We're more efficient maybe with our brain.
Exactly. You have a better way of doing it. So, you know, in certain tasks. So I think that it's clear that size of the brain is not the only factor in terms of how the brain operates.
Glad to get your take on that. I feel consoled in that sense. And again, we want to remind our viewers and listeners, you can now submit questions through audio message to Office Hours. Call the number that's on the screen. That's 949-257-2436. 949-257-2436, and you might hear your question right here on Purposeful Lab. As always, make sure to go to modracecenter.com for all the latest podcast updates, and we'll see you next week.